Hello, everyone. Today we will be talking about race and IQ. This is the first lecture on the subject. There will be a second one towards the end of the course after we've spent some time on the science and mythologies associated with IQ. I want to talk about it also right now because in some sense, in a deep way, the history of IQ testing has been accompanied with the history of scientific racism based on alleged IQ differences between various racial groups. In fact, it is not completely false to say that racial discrimination has been one of the driving forces of IQ testing right from the beginning. Well, right from the beginning is actually technically false. IQ tests were originally invented in Paris around the turn of the 20th century by Alfred Binet, in order to identify kids who might require remedial help because they were not performing equally well at various verbal and other tasks as the average kid was expected to do so at that age. Binet did not have a hereditarian interpretation of what his tests indicated. They could just as easily have been because of family circumstance, economic background, or something like that, that some kids were not doing as well as the others. Now, the IQ became an entirely different story once it was imported from France into the United States roughly around 1910, and then it was extensively used during the First World War to find out what would be the most appropriate military use of recruits who came from every segment of the population as far as class or race goes. And after World War One was the first time when people began to notice that there were systematic differences between average IQ scores of different racial groups. And then IQ became a tool of racial discrimination ever afterwards. And that's the context in which I want to talk about IQ and race today. We will come back in some detail on exactly how IQ tests are constructed and why, in some sense, they end up producing exactly the results that the designers of these tests want, whether it be discrimination on the basis of race, discrimination on the basis of gender, and things of that sort. So, but that's a story for another day. Right now, what I want to focus on is the fact that the mythology that there are racial differences driven by genetics and heredity between IQ and in the performance in IQ tests, that this idea just simply does not go away and is revived. It's probably revived over and over again because scientific racism similarly has never gone away from our society. And what I want to do is to track this story backwards by looking at three different episodes of this history. And I'm only going to go back to about 1970 because that is the period in which a particular genetic technique called heritability analysis began to be used to say that IQ and other behavioral features of humans like that have a genetic origin. And because they have a genetic origin, the argument goes, they cannot be changed. So let's start with the most recent episode. So we are now in 20 years after when the Human Genome Project first produced something that it called a draft sequence of the human genome. When that sequence came out, people jumped on the bandwagon to argue that 99% or even higher percentage of the genome sequence is exactly the same between human beings. In other words, different human beings do not vary that much at the genetic level, no matter how serious the variation might be at the cultural level. And this was taken to be the end of racism. In the next lecture, we will actually look at why that story has turned out to be exactly the opposite of what people were claiming of it in 2000, when a book came out called Against Race, and argued the genomics has shown that racial categorization are simply do not work. Instead, what has happened is, for a variety of different reasons, which we will look at in the next lecture, genomics has led to the reinvention, reinscription, as it is often suggested, of race through genomic data and genomics. And so in 2014, a book came out called Troublesome Inheritance. The author of the book was somebody called Nicholas Wade, who has had a pretty illustrious career as a science journalist. He worked for Nature, had an editorial capacity there. Nature is the premier scientific journal coming out of Europe. For some things, as in the biological sciences, it still remains the gold standard. He similarly ended up working for Science, which is the most important or most prestigious general scientific journal to come out of the United States. It's published by the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And Wade had an editorial position in that too. And then he worked for the New York Times and wrote for that. Wade claimed that in this book that what science had revealed, and this is a respected a science journalist with quite a lot of experience talking, so he's speaking from what the general public would take to be a position of authority. And he claimed that recent science, in particular genetics, have shown that there are very significant racial differences between the various races, and that political correctness is why this has all been hushed up, and science is not willing to face up to the fact that there are these differences between human beings that exist, and these differences are due to the genes, right? Now, as all of you know, I am somebody who does not defend political correctness, and I urge people to have as much individual liberty as possible. But is it really the case that political correctness is responsible for science refusing to deal with race? Well, in one sense, it's obviously not. I mean, what we saw in the last lecture was every time we try to give a biological definition of race, we fall afoul of the fact that most of the variation in human beings is within groups and not between groups, and that human beings and this variation is continuous over geographical space. And so you do not end up with discrete groups of subsets of human species that can be identified as race. Wade, in fact, is really curious. He decided that there are still only three really different races: sub-Saharan Africans, Caucasians, and East Asians. It's almost as if we are back to 1800 with Blumenbach, Kant, Linnaeus, and the original classification of human beings into races that we have long left behind. He's not consistent in this, that sometimes he talks about other races, a fourth race or a fifth race, but he generally claims that they are these three races. And then he claims what science has shown, that each of these races responded differently to natural selection in different selected environments. The Europeans responded by creating the free market, by creating European standards of governance, culture, and all of that. And that's why the Europeans ended up inventing modern science and doing everything that they're supposed to be doing. By Europeans, I mean the people that Wade calls Caucasians, who generally lived in the selective environment of Europe. Okay. In contrast, East Asians are supposed to have lived in an environment which was dominated by autocratic rulers, and they were selected for that kind of a social, the social rules that are required by the presence of autocracies governing things. And so they're very different from the Europeans. They end up with a different set of temperaments because those are the ones that were selected for in their society. And of course, sub-Saharan Africans, from Wade's point of view, were selected in tribal societies. They were subdivided to a variety of tribes. And so what was selected for in their behavioral features is tribalism. And so now we clearly have a hierarchy here where the Caucasians end up on top, the East Asians second, and the sub-Saharan Africans, as usual, in the bottom. Now, one thing that you will have to remember is that whoever builds these racial hierarchies always ends up putting his or her race on the top, and Wade is no exception to this rule. You might even call that the first law of scientific racism. You can make a prediction that you scratch a scientific racist, and the scientific racist is going to put that his or her particular racial group near the top or at the top, and put others below. The second rule of scientific racism, of course, will be to put black people of sub-Saharan descent, or descent that it comes from black Africa, always at the bottom. They always put there, and this is one way in which people, especially whites and others who have enslaved Africans, justify what they had done. That what they had done is not not horrible. There is actually a biological basis for it. And that is supposed to be a justification not only of slavery as it was practiced and promoted by the Europeans, but also of different insidious forms of racism that we have seen in European and neo-European societies since that time. Now, Wade, in fact, the most interesting thing about Wade's book was, is for all its provocative claims and all of that, he pays absolutely no attention to the evidence. And at some points, he's honest enough to realize that there isn't any evidence that backs him up, that all he's indulging in is speculation. But he managed to offend actual biologists and geneticists whose works he had covered to such an extent that over 140 of them wrote a letter to the New York Times Book Review decrying decrying what Wade had claimed about genetics, pointing out that there was no evidence that he understood the genetics of what he was talking about at all, and many of them went on to point out that he had severely misinterpreted their own work. And that's the most recent episode. So after that, by and large, his book has been forgotten, but probably 15 years from now, yet another book will come out, unless our society changes radically in between, which will make the same sort of claim over there. In fact, exactly 20 years before Wade, you had the second of the three episodes I want to talk about happen. And that was the publication by two persons, Richard Herrnstein and Charles Murray, of a book called The Bell Curve, where they tried to snow you with data showing that various behavioral traits in others happen to have a certain normal distribution, that is the bell curve, and the mean of the distribution is different for different classes and different races. So effectively what they try to show is that when you look at all this performance of these different groups, then economic factors do not provide as good and evidence for them as is provided by racial origin. Again, much of it is statistically hogwash, as lots and lots of people have pointed out. In fact, Herrnstein has been making these claims since the 1970s, and all that had happened in 1994 is that he had collected a bunch of data and carried out a single kind of statistical analysis, multiple regression over and over again to try to prove these things. Now, in some sense, the data he presented are not surprising at all. We do know that the performance of certain kinds of tests varies between groups in the United States, and this probably is a result of the practice of systematic racism for generations in this country. In fact, it has been clear, these data are not up for question, that if you look at the average performance of African Americans versus white Americans in the United States going back to the First World War, there is a difference. But as we shall see when we get to the section on IQ in this course, that this difference has been dwindling. And what people tend to forget is that exactly the same impact, the same kind of difference is not seen when you look at other societies. For example, if you look at children born to German women out of wedlock because they had mated with American soldiers, and you look at the children that were born because the father was white American and the father was black American, in the context of growing up in German society, there are no visible differences. I mean, no differences between them in terms of their performance on IQ tests or other behavioral tests to which they have been subjected. That's the kind of stuff that's forgotten. But what's forgotten also, that many times when IQ tests were carried out with people of Caribbean origin in Britain and compared to native English, once again, you have a black-white difference. Very often in the schools in London, it turns out to be the case that the people of Caribbean origin outperform the people who were of English origin. So there are these differences, and the differences that we see in the U.S. are markedly what? Presumably because of what has societally has happened to the U.S. Now, just because you have this difference, and because this difference is corresponds to membership in a racial group, of course, a multiple regression will pick that out. But multiple regressions and all of the statistical techniques at the end of the day only pick out the correlations. They do not establish causation. And Herrnstein and Murray carefully hide this fact, and they pretend that they have actually told a causal story. I don't want to go into the details of the bell curve anymore now. Their scientists responded extensively in the 1990s to the various fallacies and other things that they had committed. But the crucial philosophical point I want to mention here over and over again is that they did not even attempt to establish a causal link beyond correlations in the claims that they made, and that they that even though they snowed people with data, whenever it is that somebody who was competent statistically examined the case that they had presented was very weak. Indeed, as Stephen Jay Gould pointed out in a scathing review he wrote of the book in The New Yorker. Now, in fact, what really should be interesting, or what we should focus on when we go back to it, is the date, 1994. This was during the Clinton administration, at a time when, thanks to Newt Gingrich, basically most of the welfare programs that had been created during the LBJ years in the late 1960s in the U.S. were more or less destroyed. That's what created temporarily a huge budget deficit and budget surplus and things of that kind. We stopped social spending. And that is the ideology that the bell curve supported. The idea here being is that if there are biologically different, biologically based performance differences between the different races, wasting money on social programs that are supposed to make the social situation for these groups more equal to each other was a complete waste of money, because if something is biological, then it is going to be immutable. So that's a short story of the 1990s. Actually, this story goes back to 1970. Okay, and 1970 is about the right time for it to start. So how do you establish that just from the basis of carrying out these different kinds of measurements in different groups, how do you establish that the differences you're seeing are due to genetic differences? The standard technique that psychologists and behavioral geneticists tried to use was something called heritability analysis. And this was only invented during the Second World War in 1943 by somebody by the name of Lush. And we will have a lecture entirely on heritability analysis later on in the course. And some of you I know have been looking at a book that I published in 1998 called Genetics and Reductionism. And there is an extensive chapter on heritability analysis in that book. Now, so heritability analysis then post-World War II made it possible to try to find out the genetic basis of a variety of different traits. It actually does not tell you very much about the genetics of individuals at all. As we shall see in the later lecture, it basically tells you what exactly, how much of the variation in a trait can be explained by genetic variation within a population, so long as we are talking about exactly that population with its genetic composition and the environments to which it has been exposed. Much of heritability analysis is actually quite uninformative, but that's what enabled but its importance of the story lies in the fact that it constituted a new technique that could be used in order to deal with these sort of questions. And so it began to be used in the 1960s. And what marked the 1960s was the Civil Rights Act and all the various measures by which people tried to get away from many of the problems of the past, especially problems of racial discrimination in the United States. And into this context then jumped in a Harvard psychologist his name was Jensen, and he claimed that heritability analysis showed that there was a very severe limit to how much we could boost performance, academic performance, IQ scores, and all of that, simply because the variation that you saw was due to the genes, and the genetic composition of different races was such that you could not bridge the differences between them. Now, that was the first episode. And what we have seen then is that this episode starts in 1970, exactly the same. And Hunstein was one of the people who wrote a paper arguing this point even back then, when he did not have the data that he thought proved his point, which is what he did in 1994. So you got it in 1970, you got it in 1994, and then you got it in 2014 in a slightly different form. Wade is more aware than during the earlier episodes that heritability analysis is problematic and does not quite show what it is supposed to be shown. In fact, the most important result of that first episode of Scientific Racism, the attempt to connect show that there is a connection between IQ and race, and that this connection is due to genetic factors that's going to differ between the various races. What that first episode is important for is it led to a wide variety of scientists really focusing on what heritability analysis did. And this include people like Mark Feldman, Dick Lowington, David Laser, Oscar Kempthorne, And by and large, as a result of that, but by 1975, it had already become clear that heritability analysis does not provide the kind of technique that would actually establish the differences between races that these people were trying to establish. So what's the take-home message of this lecture? I am going to stop in a few minutes. The take-home exam is that even though, as we saw from the last lecture, there is no biological basis for race, because there's a perception that there is something biological about race, that perception has been used to bolster up racism, which remains a major problem in American society and in society in general, even beyond the United States. And that one very important tool to do so has been to argue on the basis of IQ scores that there are differences between these populations. And then going on from there, by claiming that IQ is hereditarian and caused by genes, to claim that there are genetically induced differences between these perceived races. And because these are genetically induced, these differences cannot be changed. They're immutable. And so in a certain sense, racism is a result of our biology, the result of which shows that different races are going to be very different from each other with respect to some very important tasks that they might be expected to perform. And this is written in biology in such a way that it's indelible. It cannot be changed, and there's no point in fighting it. In fact, whether we like it or not, we should face up to the fact that differences between races will remain in our society. And of course, that's exactly the claim that you see geneticists like Jim Watson make when he claims that sub-Saharan Africa is going to have no great future because the people from sub-Saharan Africa are simply intellectually deficient compared to people from Europe and near Europe. So that's the message. So part and parcel of understanding why scientific racism existed, why it continues to be a problem, part and parcel is understanding that the prevalence of IQ testing has played a very important role in this. And in fact, much of IQ research has been driven by this desire to bolster up scientific racism. All right, let me stop here, and we will return to the story again after looking at the meaning of IQ and, in some excruciating detail, the meaning of heritability and what it is supposed to show. All right, thanks. Bye.